Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
I never forget that. I never forget sitting down with Puff and saying, yo, man, what you gonna do now, man? He says, man, whatever Dre do, daddy, yo.
You. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 244, a talk with Daddy-O. Glenn Daddy-O Bolton is a rapper, producer, executive, and all-around hip-hop renaissance man. He formed the groundbreaking Stetsasonic in 1981, and the group went on to release several classic albums and became the first great hip-hop band. As a producer and remixer, he worked with everyone from Audio 2 to the Red Hot Chili Peppers to They Might Be Giants. He was an executive at MCA and Motown and continues to consult with a number of companies. And he's still releasing music to this day. Daddy-O's latest album, released this past May, is No Tablecloths. I caught up with Daddy-O via Skype as he was in a coffee shop near his home in Houston. While you're listening, head over to thecyphershow.com to check out show notes, playlists, and our archives. When you're done with the episode, you might want to listen to our interview with another Stetsasonic member, Prince Paul, on episode 98. Also, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future shows. Now is a good time to remind you that the best thing you can do to support us is head over to patreon.com/thecyphershow and throw us a few bucks. We spend a ton of time working on the show each week, and those donations really help us to keep it sustainable. Which is worth more, the cipher or that overpriced latte? And now, here's the man who'll remind you, just in case you forgot, that you can be a daddy, but never Daddy-O. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me, man. I really appreciate it. What's going on in Houston?
So I've been in Houston for about a year and a half. I came for my grandson, and then I got a 9-year-old. So it was like mid-school season. So we ended up getting her into school, and I ended up loving the school. So now we did second grade and third grade in Houston, and we're thinking about fourth grade as well. Not that I really love the city too much, but I really do love this school. It's nice. And what I do for work, besides the music, I can do from anywhere. So
let's start there. Seems like a good jumping off point. What are you doing for work these days other than the voluminous amount of albums you've been releasing?
So I've been doing this digital, I guess you would call it digital strategy, or maybe like, what do we call it? We call it content marketing. And the only reason it's, you know, kind of started off as social media management, but because video is moving so fast, because everything else moves so fast, I was part of a bunch of software operations like startups, and I was the creative guy there, right? So I end up being like sometimes 15 programmers and me as the one creative. So I would have to bring in like the music and video and kind of figure out where the entertainment piece met. And that's just kind of sort of where the marketing did. So it kind of created a business for me where, you know, I could actually do content strategy. I could take a dry cleaners and tell them what they need to do online, which networks they need to use, whether or not they need to cut a commercial or not, et cetera, which social media networks to use, you know, that kind of thing.
Did that skill set come out of your time at MCA?
From 1994 to 1998, Daddy-O was a senior director for MCA Records.
No, but the interesting part, it's so funny you mentioned MCA. So the interesting part about MCA is, and this is cool that you said that, because that kind of solidifies that I had caught what I call the technology bug even back then. When I started working at MCA, there was no email. When I started working at MCA, they all had Lotus Notes. I made them put T3 lines in my office. Like, they had no idea what email was throughout the universal system. It was so weird. But I was in love with technology then because I was like listening to Quincy Jones talk about reading Wired magazine. And then there was a few other magazines like Shift There was, you know, just Fast Company was real early, and I was reading those things, and I was noticing how things would just change for us. And I was just like, okay, I want to be a part of this. Like, I need to be a part of this revolution. I know I'm musical, but it's going to affect music as well. And so I did no marketing at MCA at all, but I did have like this tech bug, so to speak. And then I ended up working for .com, I don't know, maybe 6 years after that.
And so I know you were doing A&R, stuff on the A&R side at MCA. Who was your one that got away?
Smooth and Hustler, Master P, and Mystical.
Wow, those are three really big guys.
Well, I feel equal about all of them, even though Smooth and Hustler, I had that Broken Language record. I used to play it every day.
Fix your eyes on the guy that has no kind of worries if I die. So pussy clock try, danger feel step in my way. Bodies get cremated on a Friday to do or die way.
I had the first Mystical album. I had the Ice Cream album, not the Ice Cream, the one right after the Ice Cream album for Master P.
That would have been 1997's Ghetto D, which contained the hit Make 'Em Say Uh. The album went on to sell 10 million copies worldwide.
And what ended up happening was, you know, although I was a senior director at A&R, there was one guy over me, which was Hank Shockley, but then there was Al Teller and all these guys, Zach Horowitz and them, that was over Hank.
Hank, whose younger brother Keith was our guest on episode 156, was a member of Public Enemy's production crew, the Bomb Squad. He was the senior vice president of the Black Music Division for MCA Universal Records between 1990 and 1999. Al Teller was the chairman and CEO of MCA, and Zach Horowitz was the COO. In 1989, Horowitz would become president and COO of the entire Universal Music Group.
They just didn't understand this whole concept of hip-hop, independent hip-hop, how to make those things work. And they, frankly, like with Smooth and them, they just didn't move fast enough. Because Smooth and them was like, Daddy, I love you, but, you know, we're going to go see a couple of other people. So they went to see Corey Robbins at Profile, and Corey gave him a deal, like, same week.
Wow. You know, you have quite a history as a talent scout. You know, we'll obviously get to your considerable musical accomplishments in a minute, but as a talent scout, you have quite a history going back to the early 90s, right as Stet was kind of winding down. You discovered a guy in an adjoining neighborhood in Brooklyn to you. How'd you first run into Biggie?
Mr. C really found Big. What happened was this. So I'm just as, you know, and I'm not ashamed of this. So I'm just as street as I am musical, right? So I'm in Brooklyn. Me and Just, my man Just Rivera, we're friends. Un, who is Lance Un Rivera, is Just's brother, right?
No doubt now.
Lance Un Rivera is a music executive, producer, director, and screenwriter. In addition to working with Biggie and Kim, as you're about to hear, he also played a key role in Cam'ron's career. And of course, he was famously stabbed by Jay-Z at a Q-Tip album release party in 1999. Jay proclaimed his innocence publicly and on record for almost 2 years before pleading guilty in 2001.
It's really just Lil Brother, right? So Un has this idea. He says to me, you know, man, yo, man, I got this group I want to create, man, around Big. And I'm like, what are you saying? He's saying, look, man, you ever see that little girl that comes around Big? And I was like, no. He's like, this girl, Kim, she can rap. And I was like, and who else? And he's like, well, Season Them. I was like, you sure Season Them can rap? He said, well, I don't know if they can rap, but we can still put a story around them. And so basically what we did is we formed Junior Mafia in my basement. And the same, and in the same, I don't know, few months, I actually like developed Foxy Brown at the same time. So I used to have Foxy and Kim in the studio at alternate times at the same time.
Well, you know, bad stuff happens when they're in the same place at the same time. So.
On February 25th, 2001, Lil' Kim and her entourage ran into some friends of Foxy Brown's, including rapper Capone, outside the offices of New York radio station Hot 97. Tensions were high since Brown had recently dissed Kim on the Capone and Noriega song Bang Bang. More than 20 shots were fired, and Kim ended up serving a year in jail for lying about her involvement.
But it was cool.
Big was signed by that point, or?
Big was signed. He was signed to Uptown.
So it was before he got dropped from Uptown then.
Exactly. He did the split. And it wasn't just him. It was Puffy that had got dropped. I don't know what happened. To this day, I still don't know the story. And honestly, now I don't want to know the story.
Shortly after signing and recording his first songs with the Notorious B.I.G., Puffy was fired by Uptown Records executive Andre Harrell. Puff went on to start Bad Boy. Harrell told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "When I fired him, it was like I had an artist in the building. Puff wouldn't really listen to anybody but me, so my full-time job became managing Puff. And I was doing other things. I didn't do it to hurt him, but I knew it was time for him to grow."
But to this day, I don't know the story. All I know is we embraced Puff, sat him down, asked him if he needed our help. He said everything was good. He said everything was cool, and we trusted him. You know, and I was like, wait, what you gonna do? And he told me, man, I never forget Puffy saying, man, whatever Dr. Dre do, Daddy-O. And I never forget that because remember, they didn't really have a single on Uptown, save for the Party and Bullshit record, which was really more like a street record.
Bucking and bucking at niggas like I was duck hunting. Coming out just me and my crew, because all we want to do is...
But the first record that they really released on Arista was Big Poppa, and it had that same sound as those Dre records.
Oh, oh, check it out. Oh. Junior Moth, oh.
I never forget that. I'll never forget sitting down with Puff and saying, yo, man, what you gonna do now, man? He says, man, whatever Dre do, Daddy, yo.
There was something else interesting happening at that time, too, that I was curious of your take on. You know, you obviously ran Stetsasonic, and then two of your members go off with this guy, this producer guy, and they make a horrorcore album. I don't know if anyone used the term horrorcore at the time, but they make this weird, strange album called Gravediggers with this then unknown guy, RZA.
Right.
Gravediggers, come on.
Yeah. Stet members Prince Paul and Fruquan joined up with RZA and Poetic to form the Gravediggers. You can hear more about the group on episode 98 with Paul.
What did you think of that at the time?
This is what I will say about Gravediggers. I actually liked them. I didn't like any of the horrorcore stuff. Russell's nephew had a group over at Def Jam. I forgot who they were.
That would be the Flatliners.
They were four or five. Most people don't remember the Locks. Started off as the Warlocks, and they were horrorcore.
Feel the rap. I'm stomping, chewing MCs like a gorilla. The Sheik is on the scene, a well-known killer. Got no time for competition, a small time pissing. Come on, poor man.
A lot of people don't remember that. So the Locks were the Warlocks, and they were horrorcore. But the one thing I will say about the Gravediggers is I actually liked them. Like, I actually liked them. We knew RZA because, remember, RZA was signed to Tommy Boy and had that Ooh, We Love You Rakim record. Oh, yeah.
I've got too many ladies. I've got to learn to say no.
So we knew RZA from Tommy Boy, and we knew Mel Kwan from Tommy Boy. And I mean, I thought it was interesting because I knew Poetic. And I knew he was a rhyme animal. And then, you know, I've always, been a big fan of Fuquan and his voice and his cadence. And then to see RZA and Paul get together, I said, wow, this is interesting. I think it did good. It probably, just my opinion, but maybe that's just because it's my boys, probably should have been bigger than it was, but I did like it.
It's interesting you mentioned Fuquan. I know that, a lot of people see you as the center of Stetsasonic, but you've said you kind of viewed him as the basis of the whole group.
Well, rhyme-wise, because this is what happened. Delight and I started the group, and so we was the main rappers, but Kevin Porter, Shock-A-Lock, who's basically trained us to do this, period, when he introduced us to Fuquan, I mean, I just was brutally honest with Delight, and I was like, look, man, if we don't get this guy in the group, he's going to come back to destroy us. He's in the same neighborhood. We're going to be doing the same block parties with this dude. And this dude was mean. So he had this whole razor sharp, and it's to today. To today, it's the same way. If you see Stetsasonic on stage, you see me kind of command the whole. It's like and then Fuquan almost has his own entity, right? Because I could say I'm a Melly Mel. I could easily say Delight's a cowboy, but then Fuquan is a razor, you know, and he's always had this very razor sharp kind of approach to rhymes, and there was just a cadence and all of those particular things. So I mean, all the way down to the fact that when, you know, in those days, that's when the New Music Seminar was very, very popular. And I convinced Fuquan to enter the rap contest at the New Music Seminar. He lost to Shantae.
Chief on the tops and heads is my call. With superior rhymes, I'm taking all gold, crown, ruby, sapphires, belt, trophy, title, and your tire rap.
You can find the entire 1985 battle on YouTube. We'll link to it in the show notes.
But I convinced him because I, in my mind, I was like, nobody could beat him. Like, I didn't think anybody could beat him.
You mentioned something in an interview once that I thought was interesting, in that you said you viewed yourself as a rapper, that you're basically Rodney C, that some of the delivery, some of the style may be different, but that's sort of your ground zero as a rapper. What'd you take from him?
So when I'm first listening to hip hop, I hear Melly Mel. I got to be brutally honest. Mel did not always present something that looked achievable. He looked bigger than life. I think sometimes if you see Melly Mel on stage right now, he's still bigger than life. I'll fight somebody that says Mel is not the greatest to ever do it. So I'm sticking with that. Sometimes, you know, even as a musician, sometimes you just look at certain guys. I guess guitar players might look at Hendrix or Clapton like this sometimes and go, man, I just can't get to that, right? So I never really aspired to be Melly Mel because it was nothing to aspire to be. I'm not going to be that, right? And then the rest of the Furious Five, I never really wanted to be them either, even though I loved them. But when I heard the Funky Four and I heard Rodney C., there was a certain thing about his delivery. And then there was this commonsensical, that's the only way I could put it. It's probably not even a word, but there was this commonsensical delivery that I heard. And I always say a lot of it was based around this one rhyme where he said, another MC when he's running down rhymes, but half the time he just running down mine. But that's okay because I know someday I put him in check and take his rep away.
I won't buy the rhyme and I won't imitate another MC when it's running down rhymes. Cause half the time it's just running down mine. But that's alright because I know someday I'll put him in check and take his rep away. Because my name.
And when I heard him say that, I was like, I want to do that. You know what I'm saying? It was just, it was such a, he had a finesse to him that I thought, and I don't know, maybe other people had it. I'm not going to sit there and argue, you know, I can't argue with those guys like Kaz or Fantastic or Fearless or flashing them about Rodney C versus them. You know, I can only argue about Rodney C's influence on me. And so I began to take that approach, his approach to rhymes. And in the beginning, I sounded a lot like him. Until
this was in your Dr. On days?
Yeah, yes.
Dr. On was a name Daddy-O used starting in around late 1980 or early 1981.
In the beginning, I sounded a lot like him until I met Nathaniel from the original Stetson Brothers, and he gave me my growl, and he showed me the gangster rap. And once he showed me that, I started turning that around to the Daddy-O that you know today, with the delivery and you know, and the aggression and all of those particular things. So then after that, it just didn't sound like Rodney C anymore. But even when I told Rodney C, I said this before, I told Rodney C that one day, I saw him at a Zulu Nation anniversary once, and I told him, I said, hey man, I'm you. And he was like, get out of here, daddy, or whatever. And I think I seen him 2 years later, same kind of event. And he said, yo, I see what you're saying. So, you know, we buddies now. We see each other now. We embrace because he realizes that. But that, you know what I'm saying? That's my man. Like, you know, I'm not saying that I wouldn't have been a dope MC. I'm not saying that if it was in the cards for me to be a dope MC, I probably would have been a dope MC anyway. But Rodney C definitely gave me that lift.
You mentioned the gangster rock style that you got. As far as I can tell, there are two main elements to that. One is sort of a
slower delivery.
Absolutely.
And then one is sounding like you're basically on the verge of shouting all the time.
Never will we make to be ordinary. The way we rap is unique and legendary. Explicitly masked, that's up terrific. From an abs a group, or should I be specific? Delight, daddy.
Exactly. I mean, that was basically it. And then conceptually, it was always a very hard cut down, not a really soft kind of cut down. I never really, when I was learning from Nathaniel and Rocco, I never really heard them tell stories or nothing. I just heard them say, you know, like really just dope lyrics, just have dope lyrics. And so that was where we were. I was fortunate to have Delight and Fuquan and even some of the early MCs that kind of flew through the Stetsasonic clan to shape some of my rhymes to not just be one thing. You know what I'm saying? And those things, I think, are what helped me nowadays when it comes down to rhyming, besides for just listening to everybody under the sun, but, you know, to be able to kind of shape those things. Because I still could have ended up this one trick pony and not had a record like a Sally.
This story's funny. I met this girl and she had money in vast abundance. Google gobs, I mean redundance. Her eyes were hazel.
Or something like that. Still could have been like that. It still could have been a real one trick pony where everything we made would have sounded like my rhyme. But having those guys around me to kind of be even Wise at times, Wise don't always rhyme, but he was there, you know what I'm saying? To beat up against them, you know, it helped for that thing to develop. So yes, slow tempo, yes, hard delivery, yes, but then also the wittiness, a lot of that came from being in Stetsasonic.
So what was the first rap group you ever saw perform live?
Live, I think it was Treacherous for me. I'm almost sure it was Treacherous. Treacherous at the Fever.
Forget me, come on, B. We're the Treacherous, three. Gonna rock from the bottom to the T.O.P. For the people in the place, you think that record's a little bit long. You know, we don't want to run through the whole thing. We got a lot more in store. We gonna do.
Other people I wanted to see, Delight got to see Flash in them way before I got to see. I was jealous. Way before I got to see Flash in them, but yeah, it was Treacherous 3 at the Disco Fever. I did see Busy B on stage as well, but Busy was by himself. But I saw the Treacherous 3 perform as a group at the Disco Fever.
And how old were you? Do you remember?
Probably 17, 18, somewhere in there.
That would have put this show around 1978 or 79.
So before then, it was all tapes and stuff.
Yeah, everything was tape. Most of it was tapes. Like, most of it is tapes and imagination, even to this day, because I'm not from the Bronx. So being not from the Bronx and being not from uptown, not a lot of stuff came. Now, later on in life, things developed. So Flash and them end up coming to the Armory in Queens, and I got to see them. You know, Cats used to now come to Queens and perform at USA, the skating rink. So I used to see them sometimes. Cats used to come to Empire Skating Rink, which is in Brooklyn. So I used to get to see them. But for the most part, you know, a lot of it was just tapes. And then, you know, some of the unique stuff, like I love the Master Don Committee. I never got to see Pebbly Poo and them perform. Like some of the unique stuff you just never got to see. Like Fearless. I never saw Fearless before they had records. I got tapes of Fearless where they were crazy. It was nuts. But I never got to see them till after they signed the Enjoy.
D.R.B. Tito. Mike C.
Hey, girl. Hey, girl.
Pace up.
B.L.B.
Rockin' it, yes, see it.
The Fearless Four started around 1977, but didn't release their first single on Enjoy Records until 1982.
One of the Brooklyn-specific acts that you've talked about that I got a kick out of was you talked about this DJ Scooter Love, who had kind of a whole theatrical thing. What was that?
So Scooter and those guys used to have this thing called a Kickin' Coffin, and that was before, I say that's pre-hip hop, right? That's right around the time of Grandmaster Flowers and Maboa and all of those guys.
Wait, two.
1, 2, 1, 2, testing, testing, 1, 2.
For more about Grandmaster Flowers and the other 1970s New York City DJs who were from outside of the Bronx, check out episode 207 with Ron Lawrence.
And what they used to do, and I wonder if these coffins, because in the beginning we used to call DJ consoles coffins. And I said, man, I wonder if these coffins came from Scooter. Because the first time I ever seen a DJ set in a console was seeing the Kicking Coffin. And so people playing music in the park. They was in the projects in Brownsville. They playing music in the park. And then they used to have these lights. And then they used to roll the Kicking Coffin out. And they used to come out with the white gloves and all of that. And the turntables was inside the coffin. And, you know, it was still, I got this, you know, weird daddy-o philosophy where I say disco is the mother of hip-hop and reggae is the father of hip-hop. So it was still all that mother of hip-hop stuff, still all of that South Soul Orchestra, you know, Gwen Guthrie, you know what I'm saying, all of that kind of stuff. They were still playing that stuff. It wasn't hip-hop. There was no scratching yet. They were just mixing. But that is, you know what I'm saying, that, but that was, and Bobby used to live over there, so that's when I met Bobby.
That's a Sonic drummer, Bobby Simmons.
I met Bobby way before, I actually knew Bobby before I knew most of the guys in my group.
Even though he ended up being the last to join.
Because Bobby used to do the Michael Jackson. He used to be the guy who used to do that. So it was all this theatrical stuff. And then Bobby was the Michael Jackson impressionist, which he's still incredible at. You know what I'm saying? So he used to do the Michael Jackson. That's how I knew Bobby. I never knew Bobby played the drums. I knew his brother played the guitar, but I never knew Bobby played the drums. Then me and Bobby were to reunite again, even though we see each other in the neighborhood. Me and Bobby was to reunite again at the Latin Quarter when he was the backup DJ for Red Alert. And say, yo, D man, you need to let me, he said, you need to let me play drums, man, you know, with y'all live. And I was like, where are you going to put the drums? He said, I'll just put them downstairs. And I was like, you're going to put them down there on the dance floor and we'd be up there on the stage and do it? He said, yeah. I said, come on, let's try it. The group, everything I used to do, the group used to look at me like, here go D with one of his crazy ass ideas again. But we did it. It killed. And I was just like, yo, this is solid. Like, we're not going out without a drummer no more.
So you mentioned the Latin Quarter. I wanted to kind of bring up a little bit of LQ history, which is we had Tech N9ne on the show, if you know him. He's from Kansas City.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was friends with some guys who used to dance with Hammer.
Right.
And he swears, you know, my friends from Kansas City had this dance. I think he called it the shake. He said it was the Kansas City shake. That's the dance. Hammer took it and made it the Hammer dance.
So the Pop Shake was one of those dances we did. So when they went to go try out for Hammer, they said that Zester and them didn't call Carlos. And those three guys went, and they got taken and showed Hammer the Pop Shake. And next thing you know on that video, uh-oh.
You have an alternate theory of how the Hammer dance came to be.
Yeah. I say it was from Stretch and Tron, because I remember Stretch and Tron doing that thing across the stage with their legs, the uh-oh, whatever they call that thing, the uh-oh, uh-oh.
Here comes the hammer, uh-oh, 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 here comes the hammer.
And coming, and I remember Hammer used to hang with me all the time, you know, as Kirk Burrell of the Holy Ghost Boys, and I was always impressed because that, I mean, gospel rap is big now, but I was so impressed because it was gospel rap, and I was like, yo, you actually a gospel rapper? He was like, yeah. I was like, man, that is so dope. Like, I didn't even look at rap like that. Like, it could even be used like that. So I just thought it was fly that he was doing that. He used to come. He used to hang out with me at the Latin Quarter. He used to, you know, whatever. And I remember him. He used to just love watching these boys. Because even if nobody rapped, performed, Stretch and Tron would always dance up on the stage at the Latin Quarter. And so I distinctly remember them and what they used to do. And I mean, you know, somebody probably need to track. I don't know where Tron is, but I see Stretch here and there. Because, you know, Stretch ended up going on to choreograph Remember the Time for Michael Jackson.
No, you want to check me.
Stretch and Tron opened up the show at the Latin Quarter every week from September 1986 through January 1987. In addition to Remember the Time, Stretch has choreographed for Will Smith, Angie Martinez, Rod Digga, and more.
Yeah, so, you know, but I know Stretch is still around somewhere. But, you know, somebody should really ask them that. But you know what? Tech N9ne don't come, he doesn't come across to me as a liar. So, you know, and Hammer is not stupid. So more than likely, it's a combination of a bunch of stuff. And, you know, honestly, if you think about it, it's no harm, no foul. It's not really like he totally copied them.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely put his own spin on everything. Absolutely, yeah. So you guys as Stet, you were very close with Fly Ty. He was sort of your de facto manager in the early days.
Right.
Ty Williams was the co-producer of Mr. Magic's Rap Attack radio show, manager of the Juice Crew, and co-founder of Cold Chillin' Records.
So why weren't you guys on Cold Chillin', where he managed basically everyone?
Ty didn't have Cold Chillin' when he was with us. Cold Chillin' came later. When Ty was with us, Ty was just rolling with Mr. Magic. And I don't know if he was managing Magic or not, but I know he was handling a lot of business, and I think he was the producer of the radio show. But Ty didn't have Cold Chillin' then. So by the time we got signed, Ty didn't have Cold Chillin', because if Ty had Cold Chillin', then he would have literally, he probably would have been one of the groups when we won that contest. You know, he probably would have been one of the rewards when we won that contest. So I would think, I don't know this for sure, but I would think that Ty probably got Cold Chillin' whenever he linked up with Lenny. Because remember, Ty and Lenny was partners in Cold Chillin'.
That's Len Fichtelberg, the veteran recording executive who died in 2010.
So he probably got Cold Chillin' whenever he linked up with Lenny. I don't know when that was.
Right. So you talked about the contest. This was the contest that culminated in Coney Island, where you sort of won your record deal. Who did you compete against that day? Do you remember any of the other acts?
You know, I don't. But from time to time, some guys would come up to me. So there's a group from Long Island. I can't remember their name, but I saw one of them once, and he was just like, yo, remember, I was one of the people you competed against. Like, I don't remember who it was. I really, really don't remember who the competition was. But, I don't remember. But there's from time to time, this is what I was trying to say. From time to time, you know, somebody might come up to me and say, yo, man, you know, we was one of those groups in Coney Island. But, you know, right now, I'm 57, so they got to be in that same group, unless they was, you know, they may have been a little younger, but more than likely they was older. So, you know, you know, not too many people, you know, are doing it. But from time to time, I hear people tell me, hey, man, I was there, or, you know, I was a part of that.
Ah. You know, I wanted to get into the records for a second. You know, obviously the first two Stet albums, really both classics. Ghost Stetzel 1 obviously became an anthem, and it famously became an anthem that a lot of people got robbed to, you know, when it came out in the club.
Right, right.
That was the tuck your chain, everyone from Brooklyn's going in to rob people.
Right.
We boogie to the DJs nonstop, to the sound of the Brooklyn hip hop. And if you've ever seen Brooklyn rock, rock the nonstop break.
So as the creator of that song, what was that like for you to kind of witness that whole thing come about?
I don't know, man. I have to be brutally honest. Like, it almost felt, it's sad to say, but true. And I don't know. I'm not, maybe I should even be ashamed of saying this, but it kind of felt natural, right? Brooklyn has always been very aggressive. I mean, I guess the new Brooklyn is not aggressive. I guess they kind of yuppie and bupping it up and soften it up or whatever. But Brooklyn is always been aggressive. I mean, you hear Chris talk about that in the South Bronx record, where he says, you know, Manhattan, you know, keep on making, Brooklyn keep on taking it.
Manhattan keeps on making it, Brooklyn keeps on taking it, Bronx keeps creating it, and Queens keeps on faking it.
You know, there's another record that he got where he said the dreads in Brooklyn was crazy.
It was 76 to 1980, the dreads in Brooklyn was crazy. You couldn't bring out your set with no hip hop because the pistols would go.
So, like, you know, people always knew us for that. They knew us for that aggression. Did I want it to be anthemic for that aggression? No, but it didn't seem, it almost didn't seem out of place for it. Interesting thing about that is that, and I, Delight and I kind of pride ourselves on this, is that we never had any fights or robberies when we were performing, because we solidly had a belief that if we were good enough, we would entertain everybody all the way through to the robbers, and that nobody would want to even get into that kind of drama. And though, very interestingly, none of that drama ever happened when we was on stage. And so we took a little pride in that.
So jumping ahead to the next record, you have Stet Troop 88.
Right.
And on there, you say you used to make go-karts.
I used to make go-karts. Now rapping is my art. Scott LaRock still lives inside my heart.
So now, was that just because you needed a rhyme for the word art, or was that true?
No, no, no. Go-kart. The go-karts we used to make, right? So you take a 2x4, you take the wheels from a shopping cart, because, you know, a lot of shopping carts have four wheels. So you take the four wheels from the shopping cart, you make the axle on a 2x4, and then you take a wooden, sometimes we use metal, but most of the time a wooden, you take a wooden milk crate and put it on the front. And then you got your go-kart. You know when you can see them? You can see them in Owl Gang. You ever seen that show with Alfalfa, Spanky, and Buckwheat, Owl Gang?
Right, right.
You see the go-karts that we used to make.
They don't sound dangerous at all.
No, they're not. No, they're not the go-kart. The go-karts of today with the motors, like, we never had motors. This was just something. And then sometimes we would use skate wheels, too. There was other times, instead of using the big wheels, we would actually use skate wheels. You know, take a skate. You had to have you know, and break the skate wheels up and make a go kart.
What was your favorite hill to do that on?
Probably it's called Dead Man Hill. It's in Lincoln Terrace Park. It's on Eastern Parkway, and I can't remember the side street, but it's on Eastern Parkway. It's a street in Brooklyn called Eastern Parkway, which is along, you know, it's where the museum is later and all of that, and then. There's a park called Lincoln Terrace Park, which is not a big park. It's one of the smaller parks, but there's a hill called Dead Man Hill because it goes, it's so deep. So probably Dead Man Hill.
Nice. So one of the things that you've done, one of the aspects of your career that I haven't heard you talk about that much is your producing for other artists. So
right.
You had a couple early songs. One of them that was actually pretty funny was the MC Watch Out track, the Blind Man's Bluff.
Right, right, right.
I know you like to walk, but enough is enough. I like to introduce a dance called the Blind Man's Bluff. This dance was designed by who else but me. MC Watch Out, first blind MC.
To this day, me and Kazerny still best friends.
Oh, wow. Is he actually blind?
Yes. He wasn't born, his son's blind too, that's interesting. He wasn't born blind, but he lost his sight really at a real young age. So, he's actually blind. He's, if you trace some of my production throughout some of the stuff I did with Arista, some of the stuff I did on Giant Records, he's a writer on a lot of that stuff. Like even to this day, he still kind of coaches me when I make these records, like these new records I'm making. I always, you know, he ain't made any, but you know what I'm saying, I'll slide it through to him, like, yo, what do you think about this, especially when I do something melodic, you know, because he could sing, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, he's more of a singer than he is a rapper, but you know, but at that time we had did that. But yeah, he's really blind.
Wow. And so that's funny. Yeah. Cause you interpolate you put the Three Blind Mice melody into the record and just kind of have fun with it.
Yeah.
Come on, y'all. Let's do the Blind Man's Bluff. Like this.
You had another thing right around that era. Positive K was the Quarter Gram Pam, which is like a pretty sparse record, like use of samples and stuff.
That flam way back in the day at every jam. All the guys loved the girls, couldn't stand her, cause she just freaks from Hannah, Texas, Montana.
Can you talk about making that kind of record and, you know, getting used to producing and using samples, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I say this often, and I think it relates to production as well, right? So our concept always, when I say our, I just mean me and whoever you saw me around, was always this concept of the extension of Black music, not in particularly a genre, right? Yes, it was rap, but we ain't really looking at it like that, because the only heroes that we have are the R&B that comes before us. Now, granted, some of our R&B heroes might have been the funkier ones like James Brown or the Meters or whatever, but these are the heroes that we have, right? So even using samples, there's two things that we're thinking about when we're using these samples. One is DJ turn, well, later on to be called turntablism, but let me just say DJ turntables, right? So one is samples are allowing us to do some of the things that we would have had to have a guy stand behind turntables and backspin for 4 minutes or 5 minutes. That's one thing. The other thing it's doing is it's allowing us to do things in multiple spots where you, unless you did an overdub, you couldn't do it, because let's just say a guy was backspinning to keep a beat. You would have to do that all the way down. Then you have to come back with an overdub to do some of the scratch-ins or whatever, that kind of thing. And then I think overall, it's like, okay, so how do we make a dope record? We know we want to hear some of the stuff. And remember, I always say this, you know, hip-hop is music collage all the time, right? Hip-hop is always two turntables and a microphone. And if there's ever some hip-hop that people don't like, mark my words, it's because it has abandoned the turntables and the microphone. Because when it comes back to that two turntables and a microphone, you love it all over again, right? And that happens throughout the history of this music, whether it's something with trap, whether it was that Rich Boy record a few years ago, that sample, you know, like, switch, it doesn't matter.
Do you love me? Do you want me? Are you gonna call me like you said you would? Is this really your real phone number?
Get money.
Rich Boy's 2006 hit Throw Some D's sampled Switch's 1979 track I Call Your Name.
Is this really your real phone number?
But that's what it is, right? So the other thing is, you know, these interpolations of what we're doing. Quarter Gram Pam was a skin type by the Ohio Players, right? And how do we do that? How do we flip it? You know, those particular things. So that you know, and it was just, again, the other thing is that, you know, it is about this newness. I mean, I can't even front about that. Like, it is really, really about this newness. And like, okay, now it's me in the studio. Now it's not me listening to James Brown records or Earth, Wind & Fire records or War records. It's like me making them. So how does this end up coming out on the other side? So we're studying. I know I am, and I'm sure Premier probably say the same thing, and a few of us. I know Paul will. We're studying as much as we're making.
For sure. You know, you ended up making one of the most quoted, most referenced, most sampled records of all time in rap, which is Top Billing.
Audio 2's 1987 song Top Billing has been sampled or interpolated over 270 times. To hear more about the song, check out episode 40 with Audio 2's Milk D.
So a lot of people know about that. It was a mistake. There was a drum pattern stuck in the thing. So you hear this mistake that ends up becoming the beat. What made it jump out to you that, like, this is worth keeping?
Milk. That rhyme. Because remember, he comes, he plays it, but then he, you know, he's not, okay, we upstairs talking. He's not saying, come downstairs and hear this beat. I got something I want to write to it. He's saying, come downstairs, and he does an entire song. And when you heard it, just same way it affected you, I don't know where you was the first time you heard Top Billing, but trust me when I tell you, the way it affected you when you heard it first is the exact way that it affected me when I heard it first. And I heard it first live, him saying it. And I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, I always tell the story, like, he does it, the three of us are looking at him, Giz, his dad and me are looking at him, and we're staring at him, and he's looking back at us like they think it's whack. And we're like, yo, that's the most incredible shit we ever heard, yo. The only thing he's saying is two things. Should I make it long? I'm like, hell no. And he's like, should I change that word knee? Because people don't know he say suckers that's down with knee.
No guilt. Gizmo's cutting up for
himself remembers the lyric differently, saying that he's rapping, quote, suckers that's down with neither one of us, no kneecapping involved.
Because why would he say suckers that's down with me? He's talking about giving a guy a knee. Like when you knee butt a guy in his face, that's what he's talking about.
Oh, I had no idea. Wow. Yeah.
And he says, should I change that? And I was like, no, don't change that either. Because remember, back in the day, you know, aggressive lyrics was criticized. I mean, speaking of the Audio 2, remember the Audio 2 is the group that got protested by the gay group at Atlantic Records when they put their album out.
What you looking at, black? Why you staring? Is it what I'm driving or what I'm wearing? Are you looking at my girl? Because she's fine.
Audio 2's 1990 track, What You Looking At, from their album I Don't Care, attracted attention for its homophobic lyrics.
Get a quick glance and be out of here. I can't understand why you're looking this way. What's the matter with your boy? Are you gay?
Like, that was the first gay protest against rap, was with the Audio 2.
Mm.
That kind of slowed what they did in terms of the whole progression of the album. And that started a whole lot of controversy, and that the Audio 2 is kind of the sole, I can't say the sole reason, but they definitely more like 51%, you know, you go, you know, 49, 51, they more like 51% of why later on, now when you're making these rap records, you had to submit your lyrics. In the beginning, I can't tell you I submitted my lyrics for Ghostetsa. I submitted the lyrics for My Rhyme. I didn't do it. They heard it. They put it out. If something sounded like a curse word and they didn't want me to use it, they said it. You know what I'm saying? But after the Audio 2 and after this whole thing that happened with Atlantic, now everybody wants to see the lyrics, all of that stuff.
When you started really making albums, right, 86, 87, 88, that was a period that at some point later on, people started referring to that kind of like maybe 87 through 90, 91 period. People started throwing around this term golden age. That was the golden age, right? That was when albums were created, whatever. When did you, as someone who's actually making records in that period, when did you first start hearing that term being used to refer to that era?
Oh, man, it was years, like years. It was after the 2000s when I heard the word golden age. I never really heard that because you want to say something. It's interesting that you asked that question, too. I think that's a great question because I think that's a great, great question. Let me tell you why I think it's a great, great question. Because it proves that we never really thought we was going to stop. It proves that we never really thought we were going to improve. We didn't think of somebody saying golden age. We thought, you know, it's just going to get better and better and better. And even without, you know, Prodigy, you know what I'm saying? The people that was going to come after us, we just figured, look, we did this. They're going to do it better. Somebody else is going to do it better. And even if we're still doing it, they're going to come with some more. They're going to come with some more. It's going to be doper. It's going to be flyer. It's going to be all of that particular thing. So I didn't hear that terminology till me probably late, at least mid to late 2000s. I think it got a little stale. Stuff started getting a little stale around the Little John era. And when it got tinkly, then people started talking, people started looking back.
And one of the cornerstones of the golden age in some ways was the Self-Destruction record, you know, kind of a gathering of so much of the talent at the time.
Right.
So you were obviously heavily involved in making that.
You want disco, now close one more, you ain't guarding the door. So what you got a gun for? Do you rob the rich and give to the poor? Yo, daddy, yo.
Straight from the mouth of why and daddy yo
do a crime,
end up in jail, and gotta go.
Cause you could do crime and get paid today,
and tomorrow you're behind bars in the worst way.
Far from your family.
So how much of a pain in the ass was it to get everyone together to make the record and then again to shoot the video?
Two things. One is not a pain in the ass at all. Really, I mean, it was a joy because everybody wanted to do it. I mean, we understood. Remember, Self-Destruction was done for a cause. It was done because, you know, I tell the story very simply. You know, you got the Latin Quarter, you know, you got real people, the real 50 Cent, Pig Dog, you know, a bunch of, you know, known New York City, I don't want to say thugs because thugs are a whole other word, but you know what I'm saying? Known New York City street dudes, tough guys, you could call them made guys, whatever. And, you know, they about their business. So, you know, whatever that means is whatever that means. But a lot of times that also meant that people was going to get robbed if you wasn't protected, or if you just came soft or whatever. And then you got that. So, and then you got that lifestyle that's hitting, right, where everybody is wearing the Dapper Dan clothes and the gold chains and the Bally shoes and all of that. And then you got these guys in Jersey that that life. So they coming out to New York to do it, and they buying the gold chains and all of that kind of stuff. But they soft. And what happens is one of them is getting robbed and he gets killed. And they kind of blame hip hop. They kind of point the finger at hip hop.
Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem.
KRS-One started the Stop the Violence movement after a young fan was killed at a Boogie Down Productions and Public Enemy show at the Nassau Coliseum in September 1988. According to KRS, the victim was stabbed over his gold chain.
And so Chris comes up with this idea to do the self-destruction record. D-Nice produces it. And it wasn't hard at all. I mean, the brutally honest part, you could tell what the hard part on with self-destruction. If you look at the video, it was hard to get Public Enemy.
Right. Their stuff is shot separately.
Exactly. That was the only hard part. Flavor's there, but you don't see Chuck. You don't see Public Enemy. So that was the only hard part. But other than that, it wasn't hard at all. Speaking of self-destruction, so for years I've been working on this idea for self-destruction too. So I'm finally...
I was going to ask, you have been talking about it for years. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm finally getting with Sean Franklin and company, and we're figuring out how to pull this together. Different idea, but definitely same spirit. But we definitely going to do it though.
So in 93, you put out your first solo album, even though it wasn't your first attempt at recording a solo album. I think there was another unreleased one. But,
right.
You know, You Can Be a Daddy, But Never Daddy-O. And a couple of the songs on that, including the title track and the title itself, kind of reference this fact that, like, around that period, there were a bunch of people who used Daddy in their rap name.
Right.
Not to be the negative, I'm positive as K, and I don't want to talk about MCs all day. So let me make it clear, no matter how far you go, you can be a daddy, but never Daddy-O. So.
Were you the first rapper you know to have Daddy in your name?
Rapper, yeah. Not the first one to use Daddy or Dad. Daddy-O is an old term that the Philadelphia DJs used to use and stuff like that.
One of the earliest uses of Daddy-O by a radio DJ was in May of 1949, when Vernon Winslow took the station WWEZ in New Orleans to officially integrate radio in the Big Easy. Winslow's on-air name, Dr. Daddy-O.
But I don't remember a daddy.
Did you feel like the members of Crisscross and the Granddaddy IUs and whoever, like, did you feel like they were like actively, intentionally copying you?
Oh, no, I didn't feel like they were exactly. By the time those guys came, I was already the way we would say it. I was already standing on my square. So I didn't I didn't have any. You know, I didn't really care. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't a Crisscross fan, but IU know I love him. We supposed to be trying to do something together soon. IU, I love Kane, you know, all of them.
But you were just kind of taking the name back a little bit on the song.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talked about it. I always got a little crew around me. So at that time, it's Keith Arder, one of my best friends, Richard Rare, who's my engineer friend, Bob Coulter, who's another one of my engineer friends, because Ernie's there, you know, a few of us. So we all talked about it. And when Ed Man gave me the track, I was like, wow, that's kind of crazy. And I started doing a little rhyme and I said, you know, this is dope. This is dope. Like, I could do this. What do y'all think about this? You know, you could be a daddy, but never daddy-o. And they was like, that's a hot idea.
Nice. And also on that record, you have your own take on the West Coast sound that was bubbling at that moment, Brooklyn
right.
Bounce.
Non-stop like a vet with a soft top. It's 93 and I'm coming for my props. And what better way than to bounce so you can get paid by the pound and more for the fucking ounce. It's the
So what was the idea behind like claiming that sound for Brooklyn?
You know what? I think when I look back, there's one thing that I notice And it's real interesting. You know, I've never heard anybody mention it, but I think I was so influenced by the X-Clan that if you notice, both of my first two singles on You Could Be a Daddy But Never Daddy-O were samples that the X-Clan had used previously for singles.
Ah, which songs were the first two singles? There was Brooklyn Bounce and what else?
The Brooklyn Bounce and Flowin' in Five.
So I'ma sing a song to you. You're either friend or foe. So what you gonna do? Cause I'm
Flowin' in Five. Brooklyn Bounce samples Zapp's More Bounce to the Ounce, which X-Clan used on Heed the Word of the Brother. Flowing in File samples Red, Black, and Green by Roy Ayers Ubiquity, the same song X-Clan used on Raise the Flag.
I know we liked More Bounce to the Ounce, and we used it. Now, listen back to it. I don't know if I like the remix better or the original. I love the remix as well that we just used the Get Up and Dance, the Freedom track.
And if it sounds like something you heard before, it's all the more reason to get on the dance floor and rock with the play-by-play I now of the Brooklyn Bounce.
And then, you know, I don't know. It's just we just like doing it.
You are one of maybe three or four people in the hip hop world who I've ever heard talk about Mobb Style.
Right.
So I want to take a little interlude and talk about them. You said they made the best street records.
I said they made the realest. I mean,
real enough, right? In that they had an actual street guy in the group.
Style was a Harlem group in the early 1990s. Among their members was actual drug kingpin Easy Faison Jr., whose life would later form the basis of the movie Paid in Full.
I mean, you can watch my words carefully, but yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I learned about Mobb Style because I got a nephew. His name is Tim Street Black. Actually, you know, shout out Tim Street Black. He just came home, just did 10 years, came home. He's doing well. But my nephew and all the cats uptown, they always love Mobb Style. Like, that was their thing, Pretty Tone and all them. So I listened to it, but when I go back to it, I always say, it wasn't like I disliked Mobb Style then, because I always had a penchant for things that people didn't call pristine rap talent, right? For instance, one of my favorite MCs is Andre Nicotina from Sacramento. A lot of people listen to Nicotina think he's whack. It doesn't sound whack to me. I like Ice-T real early. A lot of people listen to Ice-T today and say Ice can't rap. You know what I'm saying? I always had a penchant for the whole overall delivery of the thing, just understanding that everybody's not going to be the same. And so Mobb Style was not super duper popular amongst, say, my peers, because all my peers wanted to be these rhyme animals. And so, you know, Tone and them didn't really cut it in terms of just being, you know, these fly vocal acrobats. For me, I understood it because it was street music, and I thought it was street. The same way I understood the Houston music when it dropped, same way I understood E-40 and the Click when they dropped, I thought it was street music from a street perspective. And I said, man, you can't get any realer than that. And this is probably the only time this has ever been done. You might hear it done one or two times in some blues, one or two times in some what they call liquor house music. But hip hop is the only place these guys are really able to express themselves on that level. And honestly, to me, it's still art. So I loved it, man. I loved it. To this day, I love Mobb Style.
There's a pretty famous tour that you did, I guess in maybe 87 or 88, with you guys and Public Enemy. And, you know, you guys have always said three albums came out of that tour, that it was In Full Gear, Nation of Millions, and the first De La record.
Right.
So what was actually going on? Were you guys playing old songs that would end up as samples? Were you playing early versions of songs? Were you just talking about the world? What was going on?
One is we were finding music, right? So one of the best things about touring for us, and I'm again, a good question because you got my mind spinning now. And it's just a wonderment, right? But so we are sample based. I'm a sample based producer in the beginning. And I still think, like I said, you know, hip hop's two turntables and a microphone. sample-based artistry, right? So, you know, yeah, Bam had dope records that he hid and marked out the labels, and Jazzy J had, you know, dope records that he marked out the label, but some of those records Bam and Jazzy J still got and don't tell nobody. Flash got records he played that he still don't tell nobody what that record is, right? So one of the dopest things about touring is we got to raid record shops. And so we would raid these record shops and find joints. And whether we found them on cassette or we found them on record, we really want to find them on record for the quality. It would kind of give us the idea of where we're going to go with a song or some of the stuff that we was going to do and all of those particular things. The other thing that we were doing now was, and this is what I think plays a big part for me, like in my new music, is we were hearing other people rhyme. So we were going to Miami and hearing Luke rhyme, going to Atlanta and hearing Shadi rhyme.
You wrote a song about Luke and his style. Yeah,
exactly.
My first taste of Miami bass came on my first tour. This I gotta relate. I was at the hotel, had nothing to do. Flicked on the radio, heard the Two Live Crew. Started dancing around, left them with downtown. Bought up some more shit, cause the shit was down. Then I said to
going to LA and hearing Easy Rhyme. So now we're also understanding that this expression that was created in New York, that's fair, but this expression that was created in New York was now expanding and expanding to another degree. These guys did another take on it, right? And so that was also opening us up. So all of those things, in addition to being together for long periods of time, because when a bunch of creatives are together for long periods of time, stuff happens. And so all of that was what it was, things that we wanted to talk about, things that we were seeing. You know, I always call, I love Info Gear, but if you listen to Info Gear, it's the Stetsasonic Tour album, right? It's the album, you could hear it real clear that, oh, these guys just came back and this is what they saying. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because there's a lot of styles, right? You have like, oh, this is the dance hall song.
Exactly.
Here's the song that's actually called Miami Bass and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I think all of that's valid. But I think the best answer to that question is that we were all together, and just being together, even if it was a half an idea, we got to bounce it off.
I wanted real quick to get into your remixes. You were at a period where you're doing remixes, you know, for R&B acts, but also, you know, rock bands and all kinds of things. You did the Chili Peppers. This, you did that.
Right.
How did it come to be that you remixed the They Might Be Giants song, the Istanbul Not Constantinople?
Okay, so here's the story, and I told it once or maybe I never told it. So Lisa Cortez, who's now doing film,
former guest of the show,
92.
One day went to Russell and said, look, I think I know a way we can make more money and make some of these guys money. And Russ was like, who guys? He said, like, Daddy-O, Jam Master Jay, Prince Paul. So what are you saying, right? He said, I think we should do something called RPM, Russ Producers Management. How does that work, Lisa? Basically, you allow me to go out and farm work for the producers that are in these groups, right? And so that brings in more money to, you know, we still get our percentage as management, but then that brings in more money to, you know, it does everything, because now she's talking to a whole different select group of people and all of those particular things. So Russell allows her, gives her the green light, and boom. So that's what happens. Later on, Lisa would to leave Francesca Sparrow, God bless her day, who passed away, who ended up, when she died, she was still running Puff's Bad Boy. Francesca Sparrow took it over, but it was the same program, right? And so what happened was this. I always was in love with alternative, right? I was from the first B-52's record. I loved it. You know, I always loved alternative. I knew the Chili Peppers' first album. I knew all of those records because I used to listen to the music. Some of those remixes used to come in and they would either come in and sit or come in and they wanted the Bomb Squad. And Hank and them were not really into alternative at all. And so what would happen was Lisa would convince them to use me. By the time we did the They Might Be Giants, it was a deal for me because now people understood I could do it. That's after the Chili Peppers and some of the other stuff. But I did Keith Richards. I did a bunch of stuff. They would convince them that you want a rock record, Daddy-O's the guy. The only time I didn't do one that was big, and I talked about this before, was with the Fine Young Cannibals. Fine Young Cannibals wanted Prince Paul. Prince Paul didn't want to do it, and I convinced him to do it. Because I was like, yo, you got to do this to Fine Young Cannibals. But other than that, it would either be something that would come in that nobody, that kind of the whole bunch, nobody, anybody that was producers under RPM, which is like, what are we supposed to do with this alternative thing? Or it would come in for the Bomb Squad and Lisa would say, look, just use Daddy-O.
Amazing. So you obviously recorded a ton of new albums in the past maybe 2 years or so. A lot of new music.
Yep.
A lot of it, especially on the No Tablecloths record, there are a lot of songs that center around gun violence.
Now we pay for flowers and a little plot, and funerals with money we ain't even got. We ain't asked for bullets, but we get shot. We asked for protection, and you gave us cops.
Now why has that become so central to your writing?
It's interesting because the present single, Shooting Like a Beatbox, is, I said, it's eerily timely, right? Meaning, I wrote that record before Florida, before Parkland. I wrote it before Santa Fe. Like, I wrote it before all of that stuff. But I could see it. You know what I'm saying? I could see it.
Just the other day in Chicago, a mother had to bury her baby, yo. And just the other day out in Brownsville, little Joey got killed upon the hill.
I grew up toting guns, right? So I understand what gun violence is. But I started looking at it, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This thing is a little crazy. And in particularly, I think sometimes some things are not being addressed. Let me just say it that way. Meaning, yes, police violence sometimes is over the top. And I think that we should talk about that. I don't think that anybody should be quiet on that. I think that needs to be talked about. I think gun violence in Chicago is off the chain, too. I think gun violence in East New York is off the chain, too. I think gun violence in Third Ward Houston is off the chain, too. It ain't got nothing to do with the cops at all. It's got something to do with neighborhood, inside a neighborhood doing it. And I think that we need to talk about it. And I do that from the perspective of who I am, meaning I should be able to talk about this from an OG perspective. I should be able to be the guy to talk about it, not only as a rapper, but as a guy that now is woven in the fabric of helping to create this art. And so I do it because I saw a lot of things happening, and I do it because it's so prevalent. Like right now, Chicago's at 1,000 deaths already. Right, where we in June, Chicago's at 1,000 deaths already. That's ridiculous. And so I mean, you know, I just feel like I've kind of taken on this moniker, so to speak, of the voice of causes. I feel like I'm going to spit fire all the time, but I really don't have a problem with talking about something that means something.
To that end, there's a song on No Tablecloths also that sort of delves into the history of Haiti.
Right.
Rocks, machetes, and torches. We liberated ourselves out of slavery. Aided America to gain control of New Orleans. Under Napoleon, we were the first black nation to be liberated from domination.
What was behind that?
So the whole No Tablecloths concept comes from a conversation that I had with my wife, who's Haitian, right? She was born in America, but she went to school up until around 13 in boarding school in Haiti. And, you know, she'd go back and forth. She stayed with her dad when she was there and then boarding school and then, come back because her mom was here, come back, see her mom for the summer times. When she came back permanently, she was around 13, she came back permanently and she said one day they took her and her sister out to eat. And when they went out to eat, there was no tablecloths at the restaurant. And she said she kind of flipped out, like, where are the tablecloths? And I was like, wow, that's deep, because that's America right now. That's hip hop right now. Like I'm naming that my album, No Tablecloths, and just being involved with her, I started understanding, Haiti. So a couple of years back, my friend Sibba Jibba had a little project that he was trying to put together called Hip Hop for Haiti, and he says, "Hey man, I got this idea. I want to do this thing, Hip Hop for Haiti. I got some tracks. I got like three. And I'm going to send you the three tracks. Let me know what you think." And he sent me the track for Haiti, and I did it. And once I did it, I tucked it because I had an album coming. I got an album coming sometime in the future called Personal Collection. That's like, it's not really a religious album, but it's kind of like all my personal beliefs on it. So Haiti was actually on that album. One day, Stetsasonic had a show in Philadelphia. My little man, Hasib, who rose with me, we drive in and he says, "Man, No Tablecloths gonna be dope when people come and hear it, man. When they hear Haiti." And I was like, "Yo, Haiti's not on No Tablecloths." He was like, "No, D, Haiti's gotta be on No Tablecloths." So that is Hasib that convinced me to bring it up to the forefront. But it was my wife that helped me write it. It was Sebastian with Sibba Jibba. It was Sebastian that sparked it with an idea of Hip Hop for Haiti. It was my wife that helped me write it, which is the first time I've ever done spoken word on a record at all. Mm. Right? If you notice on Haiti, I'm not even rhyming. And I didn't know I was going to do it like that. It's just like, I was just like, I don't want to try to fit this into a rhyme. I want to try to make it just flow and breathe. So I had to kind of channel my inner last poets and do it. And then it was really Hasib. That's why I give him A&R credit on the album. It was because of Hasib that it ended up being on the album.
You know, you mentioned your personal beliefs. You have kind of a record around that. I believe, and you can please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe right. You are Christian.
Yes.
But even as recently as the Everybody But KRS album, which I think is 2016, there were a lot of lyrics about the gods and earths and about Islam and things like that.
New York, nation of gods and earths, and we don't eat no pork. Sometimes fighting police, we end up lined in chalk. R.I.P. Sean Bell.
Well, see, I was raised as a five percenter, and I still have love for them. I just got love for them. So you're gonna always probably hear me shout them out. You're gonna always tell me because I have a love for them and I have a love for their spirits. I have a love for their soul. There's no friction there. You won't hear me talk about that as a belief system, but I lean on them. And here's why. And Fuquan, shout out to Fuquan, who's down with the Nation of Gods and Earth. I lean on them because I said, look, man, where we can start talking is when you start living yours out 100%. You start living yours out 100%, then we can have a conversation because it's all based on the the concept of being righteous. So if you're righteous through and through, then we can have a conversation, because we're both talking about not doing wrong, not wronging people, you know, or those particular things. But I mean, I'll always support that. I mean, it's a small group of people that they're getting smaller every year, but you know, they raised me. All my young teachers are raised me. I mean, I got a record now. We got a EP out for Shooting Like a Beatbox, and so we got a couple of extra songs on it, and one of the songs is called Shining, and you'll hear me talk about some of my influences growing up, Bar Kim and Big Tut and all of that.
Big Tut from the Borough Kings. Oh, Bar Kim from the Borough Kings. You know, at the party like the Disco Four. I'm old school, got rhymes galore.
And so, you know, you've released a ton of music over the past couple of years. You are doing the consulting work you were talking about. What else is going on with Daddy-O?
The speaking, we're pulling together. We're really, really starting to hone down on what, you know, because I speak a lot at technology forums, right? So you'll see like TED Talks on me talking about tech a lot.
You know, creatives and non-creatives, we fall into this hole. We call it putting our head down and getting some work done. And what we do is we block out the rest of the world. And if we don't know what they're doing, we have no way to know as to whether or not we're going to succeed.
It's a philosophy, but it's kind of a reality. So I've got this concept of how technology, like for instance, I believe solidly songwriters and programmers are almost the same person. It's so deep. And I've worked with both. And so my mind is always to merge those worlds, and I'm still working toward it. And, being on the digital side sometimes and being on the musical side, I realized that, yes, we've come to a conclusion with retail, say with iTunes, but we have never really came to a head where we merged those worlds. So I have a dream. I say, hey, a lot of my friends in music are out of work or looking for something new. A lot of my friends in software might put something out and it doesn't work. If I could put those two minds together, it will work, because I think software needs our mind and we need that work, right? So I've been kind of constant, ongoing. But I'm still in the background. We're still building the piece of software that I've been building for the last 6 years. You know, just trying to do those things, but really honing down on the speaking. I call them speaking gigs. Just that's my personal thing. But the speaking arrangements to basically start pulling together some forums. I have these forums I'm getting ready to do. I just had a great conversation with Bun B last week, and me and Bun is going to get together on some things where I want to actually have, you know, it's still in the beginning. I want to tackle this gun violence thing and we'll move on. But, I want to see the elders and the youth, who are the two most isolated groups, just talk about things. Because I think, you know, the young people in this country have spoken up, but then you never see them speak up with an older person beside them. And then if you do hear an older person speak up, you don't see them with a young person beside them. Biggest problem, I think, is that a lot of young people think that every older person is against them and don't remember that auntie or that uncle that would say, look, I know your mother is a little angry right now. When you get done with her, come over to my house and we'll have some tea. And we're trying to say, me, Chuck D, Bun, all of us, we're trying to say that's who we are. Like, we will listen to you. But then as a young person, you still need the guidance. You can't just, you know, you can't be 17 and lead. It's just not going to work out. That's not the way leadership works. You need some root. You need some. So if we can have those concepts, if we can have those two people talk together, that. So we're just honing in on the speaking gigs. Still DJing a little bit, when it fits, you know. I'm great for 40th birthday parties, great for 50th birthday parties, great for the classic hip hop set and the lounges with the R&B. You know what I'm saying? I don't do too much of the jumpy. I might do a hour of the jumpy somewhere at a Capri party somewhere, but not really. But doing the DJ stuff a little bit as well.
Awesome. Where can people keep up to date on what you're doing?
I'm Professor Daddy-O everywhere. ProfessorDaddy-O.com should probably be done in about a week. It's not all the way up yet, but I'm Professor Daddy-O everywhere. So if you just look Professor Daddy-O, one word, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, you'll see me. All the music is up there. We usually try to post even on YouTube, which we're starting to use a little more. You know, we're starting to see that. And, you know, we got some more stuff coming. Got a record with AZ.
I agree. Please respect, just redirect, revout, be out, nigga. I need my rest. I'm noble. Young old school, guns and soul food. Praise since my D to days as they supposed to. A mogul, mathematician.
Gonna be doing that video soon. You know, we got a few more videos we're about to shoot. So we're trying to, got some ideas. We got some ideas about how this thing is going, you know, in terms of how people are consuming music. And so we want to just stay on top of that.
Awesome. Well, Daddy-O, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to
us. Thank you, man. I appreciate it, brother.
All right. Thank you.
Daddy-O provides us with a reminder that it hasn't been that long at all since the first wave of great hip hop acts. His vivid memories of groups like the Treacherous Three and the Fearless Four are priceless, and a fantastic reminder that the golden age of hip-hop, in which Daddy-O played such a big part as a performer and producer, came directly out of that lineage. And the variety of his career is stunning. Beyond Stet, it's wild to think that the same person produced Top Billin, remixed a track for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and installed email at a major record company. I'm glad we got an idea of the entire scope of his work. Join us in 2 weeks when our guest will be Nick Cannon. Yes, you heard that right. The actor, rapper, Wild N' Out creator, and former America's Got Talent host will talk both his triumphs and his missteps in the worlds of comedy and music. Trust me, this is a special one. As I said at the beginning, the best way to keep the show going is to give us some cash at patreon.com/thecyphershow. This is what helps keep us doing the show. After you're done with that, go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Cypher Show. And don't forget, more information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
And honestly, now I don't want to know the story.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Uptown.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
And in the beginning, I sounded a lot like him.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I actually like them.
And our web guru is Aaron Young.
He lost to Sean Tate.
Thanks to Patreon supporter Gabriel Hernandez.
Man, you can't get any realer than that.
And extra special thanks to Sean Franklin for helping to make this episode happen.
I grew up toting guns, right?
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Okay, that'll be dope. Yeah.